Shrink Wrap Radio number 55, October 18, 2006, Psychopathology and the Brain. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Psychiatry today is the only medical specialty that never looks at the organ that it treats, and it's just flat out stupid. It should be considered a sin almost that you can try and kill yourself today in Sonoma, and virtually no one will look at your brain. How crazy is that? Because aberrant behavior, difficult behavior, abnormal behavior often comes from abnormal brain function. Shouldn't we be getting more information on how your specific brain works? I mean, what if you had a brain injury and it hurt the left front side of your brain, which we know is involved in happiness, and you try and hurt yourself or you try to hurt someone else? I mean, shouldn't we know that so that we can go after targeting, helping that part of the brain? And the cool thing, I mean, the reason I called this book Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, was because if I make an intervention, make the right intervention, I can actually make your brain better.
That was the voice of Daniel G. Amen, M.D., who's the author of a somewhat controversial book which came out in 1998 with the title Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, The Breakthrough Program for Conquering Anxiety, Depression, Obsessiveness, Anger, and Impulsiveness. According to the book's flyleaf, Dr. Amen is a clinical neuroscientist, child and adolescent psychiatrist, and the director of behavioral medicine clinics in four cities. Dr. Amen is a nationally recognized expert on the relationship between brain and behavior and on attention deficit disorder. And he's the author of several books, including Windows into the ADD Mind and Firestorms in the Brain. Now, on to the interview. Dr. Daniel Amen, thanks so much for agreeing to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. I've been reading.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you were able to take time out of what I'm sure is a very busy schedule to be with us. And I've been reading your very provocative and somewhat controversial book, Change Your Brain, Change Your Life. The subtitle is The Breakthrough Program for Conquering Anxiety, Depression, Obsessiveness, Anger, and Impulsiveness. And your book seems quite revolutionary, even 8 years later, given the degree to which you integrate brain scan technology into your diagnostic understanding of these disorders. So how did you first get into making the connection between the brain and these psychological conditions of anxiety, depression, obsessiveness, anger, and impulsiveness?
Well, you know, I'm a classically trained psychiatrist. I trained at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and I'm also a child psychiatrist. I did a child psychiatry fellowship, and it's fairly amazing that my training in the early 1980s really had very little neuroscience or brain science to it. We talked about neurotransmitters, and then we talked about how your childhood affected your behavior and your feelings.
Right.
And was in 1988 that I first became very interested in neurofeedback, which is measuring electrical activity on your scalp and correlating that with certain learning problems and behavior problems like ADD. And it got me very excited to think about the brain and how the brain is related to what we do. And then it was 1991 where I went to my first lecture on brain spect imaging. That's the study we do in our clinics.
And
it just did revolutionize the way I think about my patients.
Okay, people have probably heard of CAT scans and some of the other scan approaches. A spect might be new for people. What does SPECT stand for?
SPECT is a nuclear medicine study. It actually looks at living tissues. So a CAT scan or an MRI, those are anatomy studies. They show what the brain actually physically looks like. SPECT looks at blood flow and activity patterns. So if you have a car engine analogy, if you pop the hood and you just look at the engine, that's what an MRI or a CAT scan will do. SPECT is telling you what's going on when you actually turn the engine on. So an MRI of a dead person of the brain looks like a brain. A SPECT scan of a dead person looks empty because nothing's going on. So it looks at the activity patterns. And I always say it's really easy to understand a SPECT scan because basically we look for three things: areas of the brain that work well, areas of the brain that are low in activity, and areas of the brain that are high in activity. And that gives us a guideline to then treat somebody. Because if they have too much activity in a certain part of the brain, we want to calm that down. If they have too little activity in certain parts of the brain, we want to stimulate that. So we're all about using the scans to help us understand people and then to balance their brain.
Okay, now this particular approach, is it examining blood flow in the brain as opposed to electrical activity?
We look at blood flow and activity patterns, and blood flow are coupled in the brain, which means if you have increased activity, you have increased blood flow. If you have decreased activity, you have decreased blood flow because the brain has no fat stores in it, and so if it needs immediate increased energy, it gets increased blood flow.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you identify five key systems in the brain and the conditions that tend to be associated with those systems. So I wonder if you could take us through those since they're so fundamental to your approach.
The five systems I talk about in Change Your Brain, Change Your Life are the prefrontal cortex. That's the front third of your brain, largest in humans than in any other animal, what we call the executive brain. Very important, the part of your brain that talks to you, that tells you not to say certain things or not to do certain things. I think of it as like the brake in your brain. So that's a very important system that I talk about in the book. And then there's a very interesting system called the anterior. Anterior just means toward the front, cingulate gyrus, which is the brain's gear shifter, allowing you to shift your attention from thing to thing. Talk about the basal ganglia, which are involved with motivation, pleasure, and anxiety. The limbic brain, which are involved with emotions. And the temporal lobes, which are involved with mood stability, memory, temper control, learning, and so on. And there are many more systems in the brain, and I, you know, really simplify things. But, you know, the cool thing is it works when people read the book, take the checklist to see what might be going on with them, and do the interventions that are helpful for them. It literally can change their whole life. So even though, admittedly, my approach in the book was very simple, the cool thing is it really does work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you even say in the book that people can do the interventions that you recommend, even without having had a brain scan, that you have interventions that could be useful.
Well, and that's one of the mythologies about my work is that, oh, you have to have a scan in order to benefit from my work. And in all of my books, I have these cool checklists that help you predict what your scan might look like if you would never get one, because my books are published on all five continents, and we've seen people in our clinic from 51 countries. So, I mean, a lot of people read my books that never have the opportunity to get a scan, and I want them to benefit from the work that we do.
Yeah. Well, have you ever had the experience of somebody coming in and they present symptoms and you don't, and you do the brain scan, but you don't find evidence of malfunction, as it were, in the
Sometimes.
Scan?
I mean, the scans are not a perfect test. The scans, and some of the controversy about my work really comes from misunderstanding my work. People say we use scans to make a diagnosis. We never use scans to make a diagnosis. We use scans as part of the diagnostic process to give us more information. So I don't look at a scan and go, you need Ritalin. I look at a scan I talk to somebody, I think about it, I put it all together with the information that I have, and then I decide if you need Ritalin or you need another medicine or you need a natural approach to getting your brain better. So part of the controversy is really about misunderstanding what I say rather than, you know, I think when people really come to the clinic, when they get it, they get excited about it because, mm-hmm. in fact, we give people more information. So psychiatry today is the only medical specialty that never looks at the organ that it treats. And it's just flat out stupid. It should be considered a sin almost that you can try and kill yourself today in Sonoma and virtually no one will look at your brain. How crazy is that? Because aberrant behavior, difficult behavior, abnormal behavior often comes from abnormal brain function. Shouldn't we be getting more information on how your specific brain works? I mean, what if you had a brain injury and it hurt the left front side of your brain, which we know is involved in happiness, and you try and hurt yourself or you try to hurt someone else? I mean, shouldn't we know that so that we can go after targeting, helping that part of the brain? And the cool thing, I mean, the reason I called this book Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, was because if I make an intervention, make the right intervention, I can actually make your brain better. If I give you the wrong medicine or I do the wrong treatment for you, I'll make your brain worse. But because psychiatrists don't look before and after, we really don't have the kind of accountability that we need to have as a profession. Because I can hurt you. I can make you more suicidal by giving you the wrong medicine. But if I don't look before and after, I can say, oh, well, it really wasn't the medicine. You have a bad personality. And there's something just that strikes me about that as being blatantly unfair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things that I think you're touching on here is I'm under the impression that in recent years there's been a fair amount of research showing that not only does the brain shape our thoughts, but that our thoughts can shape the brain. I got the impression that maybe your brain scan studies support that idea as well.
Well, I actually published a study last year. You know, part of the controversy around my work, people say, you know, I don't publish my research, which is so irritating to me because I've published a number of papers over the last 10 years. And last year I published one on a psychotherapy called EMDR. EMDR is a specific kind of psychotherapy that helps people deal with emotional trauma. And what we found is that EMDR, in fact, changes brain function and changed it in a very cool way that makes great sense on why people feel better afterwards. So, yes, abnormal brain function can lead to abnormal behavior, but changing your behavior can actually improve brain function.
Mm-hmm.
So it works like this very cool feedback loop where you and your brain work together to have either the best or worst brain possible.
Right. So things like meditation or thinking positive thoughts or listening to classical music or learning to play a musical instrument, all of which are things that you recommend in a very holistic approach, those can actually have an effect on the brain.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very exciting frontier, I think, that's beginning to open up to us here. You know, I've had the benefit of looking at your book where you've got lots of pictures of brain scans and a number of stories about patients who came in with a presenting set of symptoms and you were able to correlate it with a scan and then able to develop a treatment program. In fact, you start the book off telling a story that got you into all of this. I think it was a family member, a little boy. Maybe you could tell us a story, maybe that one or some other one that gives people more of a feel for how all of this works.
When I first started doing this work, I was so excited. And I was excited mostly because it made me a better doctor. And I got all of these cool results from my patients.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that brings me the most joy in life is helping people get well. And I felt like I really became much better at doing what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But the controversy around a psychiatrist looking at the brain, now this is in the early 90s, was just overwhelming for me. I just couldn't believe that there would be controversy about me ordering brain scans for my patients. And for the first 5 years, I had no financial interest in it. I just ordered them as a practitioner who was excited about it. But given the level of controversy, I actually stopped talking about it with my colleagues. I kept doing it, but stopped talking about it. And then one night in 1995, I got a call from my sister-in-law who said my 9-year-old nephew had attacked a little girl on the baseball field that day for no particular reason, out of the blue, not understandable. I went, wow. I said, what else is happening with Andrew? And she said, Danny, he's different. He's mean, he's surly, he's angry, he's got this terrible temper, and I don't know what's going on. And I went in his room today and found that he had drawn two pictures, one of him hanging from a tree, and another one of him shooting other children.
Mm.
And I'm like, wow. And immediately my mind went, Andrew has a left temporal lobe problem, because I'd already had 4 years of experience with people who were violent, and we found there was just a huge correlation between violence and the left temporal lobe. And they brought him to my clinic in Fairfield, and when we scanned him, we found he had a cyst the size of a golf ball occupying the space of his left temporal lobe.
My goodness.
And when I convinced a neurosurgeon to take it out, the violence completely went away. And it was that case of somebody I love dearly that got me really talking about this again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, this is important. How many kids are in residential treatment facilities and juvenile hall? How many people are in jail when they have brain problems? And it's not just because they wanted to do bad things. And so from that moment, if you think I'm, you know, crazy for doing this, I don't care. I think you're an idiot if you don't. I mean, I'm dead serious when I say that. To practice psychiatric medicine without looking is going to be considered malpractice in 10 years, and it will be considered dark age medicine 50 years from now.
I have no doubt that somewhere down the line, and I don't know how long it will be, that what you're saying is true. I know initially you were a bit of a lone voice in the wilderness. It's been, about 8 years since you wrote this book that we're discussing now. What kind of professional reception is your approach getting these days? Has it spread to people, to practitioners, for example, beyond those who work in your own three clinics?
I have four clinics.
Okay, four clinics.
One in Fairfield, one in Newport Beach, one in Tacoma, Washington, and one in Reston, Virginia, Washington, D.C. It had. 3 years ago, we had a conference here in Southern California called Opening the Mind about using imaging in clinical practice. We had 300 professionals from around the world who
mm-hmm.
came. We have about 1,000 psychiatrists and mental health professionals who refer patients to our clinics. There are other companies sprouting up to do brain imaging in clinical practice. UCLA actually advertises on television here in Southern California about doing spec scans for psychiatric medicine.
Really?
Last year, the American Psychiatric Association gave me the Distinguished Fellow Award, which is the highest award they give to members.
Oh, that must have felt good after
criticism. Feel really good. But we're still... I wrote a book once called Healing the Hardware of the Soul, and one of my psychiatric colleagues from Berkeley sent me a letter. And on the back of the letter, he wrote, all truth goes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed, and I've been there. Second, it is vehemently denied, and I've been there too.
Mm-hmm.
And third, it is accepted as self-evident. And right now, we're between two and three.
Yeah.
In fact, Tom Insel, who is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, said last year that brain imaging in clinical practice is the next major advance in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And he's right. And he's like, he's the big boss when it comes to psychiatric medicine in the United States. And he's saying, this is coming. And I say, well, it's about time. I mean, we've had this technology available to us since the late 1980s. And too often people have said, no, not ready, not ready, not ready. And I go, well, what the heck is the alternative? The alternative is to practice with complicated patients without looking. And people go, well, there's not enough research. And I'm scratching my head because on our website today, you can go to amenclinic.com. On our website today, there's 2,020 scientific articles relating brain imaging to psychiatric medicine. It's like, give me a break. Plus, what's the standard in psychiatry? We see patients from all over the world. We see patients who have, on average, 3.5 different diagnoses per patient, who have failed 4 other treatment providers before they come to the Amen Clinic. The standard is giving people 2, 3, 4, 5 different psychiatric medications without ever looking. Show me one research article that says it's effective to give somebody 4 different psychiatric medicines. Heck, show me one research article that says it's effective to give them 3 or 2 different psychiatric medicines. There's not one. But, you know, I mean, I get criticized for looking, but I'm sorry, I wouldn't do this if I couldn't look. I would just think it's too backwards of a field.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the...
I'm sorry to sound preachy, but that's my okay. Last name, I can do it.
Yeah. Amen. Amen. Well, since
imagine growing up with a name like this, being Catholic.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah, I can only imagine. No wonder you became a psychiatrist, huh? Well, since we've opened up this can of worms here, I did... You know, I find your writing and your book very compelling, and so I always have to check against my own enthusiasm since I recognize that, wait a second, this sounds, you know, distinctly different than what most psychiatrists are doing. So I went on the web and found, in fact, that there's a website called Quack Watch, and there was another psychiatrist who had criticized your work there.
Actually, that person's not a psychiatrist. She's a family practice doctor.
Oh, okay. I think you're right.
Yeah. When you look at it, it's like, come on, you could do better. I could do better than that, criticizing me.
Okay.
I mean, there is just like, I mean, maybe you could bring up what you actually read that you thought was of substance. But when I read it, I went, come on, you got to have better substance than this.
Well, there were 2 points that stand out to me. One was the claim that your work is based on anecdotal case studies and not on double-blind studies. I'll give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, at this point, we've done 35,000 scans. We have the world's largest database. We actually have a prospective study that we did on normals to understand what normal is. We have consistently studied and reported our research when we thought it would be helpful on aggression, on attention deficit disorder, on oppositional defiant disorder, on post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a very active imaging study that has looked at, I'm sorry, very active research department that has looked at many of these psychiatric issues. So, you know, to say that it's just based on anecdotal, I mean, absolutely. I mean, initially it was based on our clinical experience, and then it was added to by the research that we did. And the other thing that is really important, because I don't think I've invented all that much, what we do is we summarize the research. And mm-hmm. if, you know, I mean, it would have been nice if the family practice doctor criticized my work would have actually got on the web, on our website, and said, you know, well, heck, there's like thousands of imaging articles as it relates to brain spect and psychiatric medicine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the idea that it's based on just anecdotal experience, well, I mean, in part that's true. But if you add in the 2,000 articles we put on our website and read and try to integrate into our clinical practice, I mean, you would be stunned to know that with dementia alone, there are 210 studies involving 13,000 patients. And like, you know, maybe there's some consistency to this research, as opposed to what she would imply is I basically made this up after looking at five patients. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, interesting.
She also said that SPECT scans are invasive and potentially harmful.
Yeah, you know, the problem with that argument is there is no evidence for that. Last year in the United States, there were, let's see if I can get this right, I think it was 17 million nuclear medicine procedures, and many of them done on children. Mm. It's fascinating to me that you can have constipation and go get a CT scan of your abdomen. You get actually more radiation than from a SPECT scan. And nobody thinks twice about the CT scan. Give a SPECT scan. And the issue, I think, is this. The radiation is not harmful to people. I mean, you get the radiation of about being outside, living in the United States for a year. That's the level of radiation you get from a SPECT scan. So the radiation was really not the issue. The issue is mental health professionals are not used to ordering lab tests. And so if we order a test that has a regular amount of medical radiation, we like flip out about it, as opposed to if a cardiologist ordered a series of x-rays for you that gave you eight times the level of radiation of a SPECT scan. No one would even think about it because, oh, this is a medical test, and the risks of the radiation are far outweighed by the potential benefit of the test. And we don't think about that, you know, in psychiatry because we're not used to ordering tests. So, radiation, oh my God, the sky is falling. When, in fact, there's no evidence that the level of radiation from a SPECT scan would ever hurt anybody.
Okay. Well, let me change direction just a little bit. Recently, I've been reading that cancer chemotherapy may have lasting deleterious effects on the brain. In your own work, have you seen any evidence of what might be called chemo brain?
Absolutely. These brains look toxic. Again, you know, how would you know really unless you looked? But what we find is it looks like people who have chemotherapy have developed a toxic look to their brain, like they were doing drugs or they had a brain infection or they had a lack of oxygen to the brain.
What about
now,
down the line?
It doesn't happen with everybody. Uh-huh. And what's really important, I've been thinking over the last couple of years a lot about this idea of brain reserve. Your brain has a lot of reserve to it. So not every head injury is going to change your life. Mm-hmm. Not everybody who gets chemotherapy has cognitive problems afterwards. It depends in part on the level of reserve your brain has. Now, genetics are involved in that, no question. But also, have you had a head injury that took away some of your reserve? Mm-hmm. Have you been abusing alcohol or nicotine that has taken away your reserve? Do you eat lousy? Are you overweight? All of those things take away your reserve so that when you have chemotherapy, you're much more likely to have cognitive problems than someone who's not had a head injury, who's not been a substance abuser, who's not had diabetes, who's not have all of those things that take away brain reserve. So chemo brain, absolutely, it exists more commonly in people who are not doing a good job of taking care of their brain. And my later book that I wrote, Making a Good Brain Great, is all about how can you have the best brain possible and how you live your life day in and day out. We implied that earlier when we were talking about the impact of thoughts on the brain. Mm-hmm. How you live your life moment by moment, day to day, is either helping or hurting your brain.
Mm-hmm. What do you see on the horizon in terms of promising research or potential breakthroughs in this interface between neuroscience and psychiatry?
I think psychiatrists are going to become more like cardiologists. You know, most people who go to a cardiologist don't go because they've had a heart attack. They're there to prevent a heart attack. And I see a day when people are going to be coming to mental health professionals like me to be keeping their brain healthy and getting checkups ahead of time before they go through a major depressive episode or a bipolar episode. I think that is going to be part of the holy grail, if you will, of psychiatric medicine. I also see that brain imaging in clinical practice is going to be standard. using genetic testing will become standard. And we're going to get to a point of personalized medicine where I'm going to be optimizing your brain rather than treating an illness like depression. Because even now, depression is thought of as a unitary concept when there's got to be 20 different kinds of depression. So we're going to be much better at targeting and tailoring treatments to individuals as opposed to broad diagnostic categories.
Very interesting. Are there any last points you'd like to make before we wrap this up?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't get it, but your brain's involved in everything you do, how you think, how you feel, how you act, how well you get along with other people. And honoring it, taking care of it, are very important. We talked earlier, I live in Newport Beach, which is a cool place to live, but it's often considered the plastic society because we have more plastic walking around the streets here than anywhere in the world. And I often say we care more about our faces, our boobs, our bellies, and our butts than we do our brain. Mm. And that's just crazy, because if we really want to be the most attractive that we can be, we have to have a brain that works right.
Great. Hey, Dr. Amen, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be our guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Daniel Amen. I confess I went into this interview with a mix of enthusiasm and skepticism. His book is written in a very compelling, convincing way, but I wasn't sure about the leap he makes from brain scans to behavioral diagnoses. I'm certainly no neuroscientist, but I'm under the impression that brain scans are still a relatively blunt instrument. We can see broad patterns of activity, but the scans don't really tell us with certainty what's happening. I don't know how accurate my analogy is, but I would liken it to those satellite pictures of weather formations. They're very useful in a broad way, but they don't tell us what's happening, say, to specific people on the ground. And then, too, a lot of his treatment suggestions in the book seem rather general and to pull from everywhere. So there were some red flags that went up for me, and that's why I thought I should look on the internet to see if there were any negative reactions to his work posted there. And I did find the one I mentioned in the interview. On the other hand, it would be hard to imagine someone doing groundbreaking work that runs against current thinking and not drawing fire for it. And the truth is, anyone can say anything they want about someone on the internet. Just now, though, I took a look at the reviews for his book on Amazon.com, and they run both pro and con. So you'll need to make up your own mind. Personally, I enjoyed this interview with Dr. Amen, and I appreciated his openness in discussing the charges of his critics. In addition to prescribing psychiatric medications and traditional talk therapy, Dr. Amen has a list of what he calls 50 brain do's and 50 brain don'ts at the end of his book. Let me quickly run through them. I'm not sure I agree with every one of them, but for the most part, they strike me as sound advice. So here's his list of brain do's. Wear a helmet in high-risk situations. Drink lots of water, 6 to 8 glasses daily, to stay well hydrated. Eat healthfully, adjusting the proportion of protein and carbohydrates to your brain needs. Take ginkgo biloba as necessary under a doctor's supervision. Think positive, healthy thoughts. Love, feed, and exercise your internal anteater to get rid of your ants. And by ants, it's an acronym for automatic negative thoughts. Every day, take time to focus on the things you're grateful for in your life. Watch the Disney movie Pollyanna. Spend time with positive, uplifting people. Spend time with people you want to be like. You're more likely to become like them. Work on your people skills to become more connected and to enhance limbic bonds. Talk to others in loving, helpful ways. Surround yourself with great smells. Build a library of wonderful experiences. Make a difference in the life of someone else. Exercise. Regularly connect with your loved ones. Learn diaphragmatic breathing. Learn and use self-hypnosis and meditation on a daily basis. Effectively confront and deal with situations involving conflict. Develop clear goals for your life. Focus on what you like a lot more than what you don't like. Collect penguins, or at least send them to me. I gather he collects penguins. I miss that part. have meaning, purpose, excitement, and stimulation in your life. Establish eye contact with and smile frequently at others. Consider brainwave, biofeedback, or audiovisual stimulation to optimize brain function. Notice when you're stuck. Distract yourself and come back to the problem later. Think through answers before automatically saying no. Write out options and solutions when you feel stuck. Seek the counsel of others when you feel stuck. Memorize and recite the Serenity Prayer daily and whenever bothered by repetitive thoughts. And the Serenity Prayer, of course, is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Take a break and come back later when you're unsuccessfully trying to convince someone who is stuck. Use paradoxical requests in dealing with singulate people. Make naturally oppositional children mind you the first time through a firm, kind, authoritative stance. Learn something new every day. Enhance your memory skills. Sing and hum whenever you can. Make beautiful music a part of your life. Make beautiful smells a part of your life. Touch others often, appropriately. Make love with your partner. Move in rhythms. Use a skilled psychotherapist when needed. Use EMDR, that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapist, to deal with trauma. Take head injuries seriously, even minor ones. Take medications when needed under your doctor's supervision. Take herbal remedies when needed under your doctor's supervision. Consider underlying brain problems in substance abusers. And number 50 in the brain do's is do full brain evaluations for people who do terrible things. Now, his list of 50 brain don'ts are as follows. Don't isolate a developing baby. Don't use alcohol, tobacco, drugs, or much caffeine when pregnant. Don't ignore erratic behavior. Don't lie around the house and never exercise. Don't ignore concussions. Don't smoke. Don't drink much caffeine. Don't drink much alcohol. Don't do drugs. No heroin, etc. Don't eat without forethought about what foods are best for your brain. Don't drive without wearing a seatbelt. Don't ride a motorcycle, bicycle, skateboard, inline skate, snowboard, and so forth without a helmet. Don't hit a soccer ball with your head. Don't bang your head when you're frustrated. Don't bungee jump. Don't hang out with people who do drugs, fight, or involved in other dangerous activities. Don't allow your breathing to get out of control. Don't think in black or white terms. Don't think in words like always, never, every time. Everyone. Don't focus on the negative things in your life. Don't predict the worst. Don't think only with your feelings. Don't try to read other people's minds. Don't blame other people for your thoughts. Don't label yourself or others with negative terms. Don't beat yourself up or others with guilt. Don't personalize situations that have little to do with you. Don't feed your automatic negative thoughts. Don't use sex as a weapon with your partner. Don't talk to others in a hateful way. Don't push people away. Don't be around toxic smells. Don't be around toxic people. Don't focus too much on what other people think. Don't allow your life to just happen without you directing and planning it. Don't take the stimulant bait from other people. Don't be another person's stimulant. Don't allow thoughts to go over and over in your head. Don't automatically say no to others. Don't automatically say yes to others. Don't argue with someone who is stuck. Don't isolate yourself when you feel worried, depressed, or panicky. Don't allow naturally oppositional children to be oppositional. Don't listen to toxic music. Don't blame substance abusers as morally defective. Don't refuse to take medications when needed. Don't self-medicate when you have problems. Don't deny you have problems. Don't refuse to listen to the people you love who are trying to tell you to get help. And finally, number 50, don't withhold love, touch, and companionship from those you love as a way to express anger. So if you do all those things and don't do the other list of things, you should be in pretty good shape.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. for insight into personal growth and the inner life, hear Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
And this is Dr. Dave, and more than I want you to put yourself on our Frapper map, more than I want you to leave a My Chingo transition, what I really want is for you to go to your window, throw it open, lean out and shout, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Oops, wrong script. No, what I really want you to do more than anything else is to take our new listener survey. By filling out this one-page online survey, you'll help me to know who my listeners are, where they're located, and what they want. So right now, before you forget about it, you can take the survey at www.shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. You'll also find a link to the survey at the top of our show's pages. Working with our sponsor, GoDaddy, you can get a discount on your next domain name purchase. For example, you could buy www.mybighealthybrain.com for only $6.95 for a year instead of the usual $8.95 just by using the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy.com. Now, we do have 4 new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Nikolaus in Ottawa, Canada, Nicola in Edinburgh, Scotland, Glenn in Melbourne, Australia, and Vanamond in Jarrow, England. And if you haven't put yourself on the map yet, you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored, in which I do a psychological profile of the infamous Zodiac serial killer. All you have to do to enter is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Or once again, you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. By the way, I don't know how you get Shrink Wrap Radio, but if you're not subscribed, let me encourage you to do so. It will ensure that you get the show regularly, and it also helps me to do a better job of obtaining sponsors and tracking statistics. Most listeners subscribe through iTunes. One good alternative is to use Juice, which is a free cross-platform software program. That's J-U-I-C-E, and you can find the link quickly using Google to search for Juice Podcast Software. Another good one is iPodder, which is also free cross-platform software. By cross-platform, I mean these will run on Windows, Mac, and Linux operating systems.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys-Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Kira. What do you say we catch up on some listener emails? Okay, first we hear from Michael, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I just heard your interview on Rob's podcast 411 show, and can't wait to download your podcasts. I wish I knew about you earlier, but now I've got tons of great podcasts to catch up on while I'm out walking my dog. Shasta will love it. FYI, I've been studying podcasting / vodcasting for about 6 months now. I've bought all the toys, great software, hardware, books, royalty-free music, and should launch my first podcast shortly. Although when it comes to Bridge, I'm sure most will go for the web-based audio cast. So I guess his podcast is going to be about the card game Bridge. I'm just guessing. On Rob's interview, you discussed promotion, and I'd like to share a tip that might provide you a real breakthrough. Perhaps you might consider adding a free regular email subscription service. Everyone loves free content, and emails have a nice viral component, with the ability to forward to others and facilitate automated sign-up. And he goes on to describe this process, and Michael, it's something I'll definitely look into and consider. And in fact, I've invited people to share their email addresses on the survey. It's entirely optional, but it would open up the possibility of perhaps having something like you suggest. Finally, Michael ends his letter with, by the way, I too am glad we're beyond the days of Fortran and Key Punch. I recall the, quotes, good old days, dropping a stack of cards and getting them all mixed up, or all those A-bend aborts. And on the side of electronics and engineering, do you still have your picket slide rule? I'm still a proud owner, although my original IMSAI 8080 is still my baby. Thanks again for producing all those awesome podcasts. I'm sure you'll be hearing more from me. Warm regards, Michael. Well, Michael, I hope I do hear more from you, get some more advice about how to use that newsletter software. And no, I have not kept any of my slide rules. What a pity. They'd probably be worth some money today. Javier writes, motivation, discipline, and concentration. These are three things that I find important for one to reach their goals. Are people generally born with these because of just chemical makeup in the brain? Or is it a progressive learned trait? Can a person acquire these? Or is it harder as you get older? What are some good ways that one could practice being more of these? These can help you overcome the odds that may be against you in life. Well, Javier, those are great questions. And I think that it's probably true that some people are born with more of those traits than others. Most of our traits do vary genetically. And at the same time, whatever the set level is that we're dealt with when we're dealt this hand of cards in our life, there is always some room for improvement through practice. So yes, I do believe that practice can lead to improvement in such things as motivation, discipline, and concentration. And certainly meditation is a subject that we've discussed several times on this show, and certainly one way to practice concentration. I got a nice note from Adam Ronskevich, who was my guest in episode number 14, a high school teacher who uses podcasting to communicate to his students. And he says they've just had a new baby girl, so he hasn't had much time for podcasting. It's great to hear from you, Adam, and congratulations. Shane sent an email a little bit back about the importance of having even volume levels across the different segments of the show. And I want to thank him for his feedback on that. And I think we're finally on top of that issue. Paul writes, hi, Dr. Dave. Paul from Sydney, Australia here. I just listened to your interview with Bert Kaplan and really enjoyed it. I've been meditating for a year or so, not nonstop, so it was very interesting. Just wanted to thank you for the great service you're giving. I can't wait to listen to the others I downloaded. I also gave you a good rating on Yahoo Podcasts. Yahoo! Great, thank you. He says, well done and keep up the fantastic work, Paul. Thanks so much, Paul. I'll bet you will also enjoy the last episode with the Tibetan Rinpoche if you haven't had a chance to hear that yet. Here's another great one. Dear Dr. Dave, look, you've got a pin on a frapper from Pakistan. Is there a prize for being the first one from a country? I really enjoy your shows. Please keep up the good work, Atta. Well, Atta, I can't afford to give a prize for each new person from each country. There are too many countries and so few prizes, but I sure appreciate your putting yourself on the map. Speaking of other countries, we got one from Stefan in Austria who writes, hello, Dr. Dave. I hope you enjoyed your stay in Italy. I also happened to spend 2 weeks there. I had some podcasts on my iPod and really liked the program about group projective dream work. Unfortunately, my FOWA course, Conscious Dying in Tibetan Buddhism, was not a great experience, so much for religious delusions. What an interesting coincidence that the next podcast will be about Tibetan Buddhism. Well, I hope you had a better experience with that podcast, Stefan, than you did with the course. I got a nice long email from listener Lloyd in Australia on my BlackBerry while I was in Italy. It reads, hi, Dave. I thank you for all the emails of mine you've read on air. A strange experience for me. Thank you in particular for your thoughtful comments concerning my antidepressant story. I've been enjoying all your latest and many shows, including your great second hypnotist installment. He's referring to the personal story I told about when I performed as a stage hypnotist on a ocean cruise. He says, if I had been you, I would have refused to do it after they disregarded all your requests, as I'm sure you wished you had. Yes, indeed. I wish to tell you about a dream, which is very important to me. One of the life-defining ones. I was walking down a street past a large house with bare, foreboding trees in its garden. In the tree, Gothic-dressed occultists of some kind were laying around in the branches, watching me pass. It was obvious that they had powerful magic, and it was also clear that they were not of the friendly sort. I might have looked an easy target as they turned their magic upon me. Lightning bolts and such came at me, and I bolted down the street, truly afraid for my life. As they chased me and were gaining, it became apparent that I did not have a chance at getting away, and surely they would do as they wished with me. At that moment, I suddenly became completely calm and centered and knelt facing my pursuers with my face down and eyes closed. I said to myself, God's will be done, and completely submitted to what lay ahead, which I assumed would be my death. Suddenly, I heard a great commotion and sounds of clashes and whooshes and who knows what. As it died down, I looked up. A great black trail lay between me and my attackers, and they were strewn across the landscape in various stages of injury. I got up and walked toward the house. The trees were in flames, debris lying around from the great destruction that had been wrought. By the look of fear in the occultist's eyes, it seemed that they thought the massive counterattack was my doing, but I had done nothing but submit to my death. I wanted to get far away from that place. I hailed an old-style London black taxi. As I got in, I noticed a book lying on the seat. I realized that this was the book of magic that the occultists had studied to gain their power, and that power was now being offered to me. I felt it had a very dark energy around it, so did not even open the cover and left it in the taxi. That's the end of the dream. To me, the message requires little interpretation. That the power of God is far greater than any power we can gain here on earth, no matter if obtained from earthly or other means. Those who submit to the will of God may temporarily gain the power of God, as is his will. It was also of importance to me that I did not pray to God to save me, but rather submitted to whatever would happen. Thus, God's actions of vanquishing my foes was not at all directed and precipitated by my will. Thus, I do not have responsibility for those people's harm. My refusal of the occultist's magic book was a logical one, given that it had just proven worthless. Nevertheless, I felt proud that I was able to leave it and thus not desire the power for myself. Hope all this fits on your BlackBerry, Lloyd. Lloyd, thank you for sharing that very important dream. To me, your dream sounds like it might have an element of lucidity, which is to say that you were conscious enough within the dream to make some key choices, not to run away from your enemies and not to open the dark book. In dream work, we encourage people to deal with nightmares by doing just that, becoming sufficiently aware of the fact that they are dreaming to make the choice to somehow confront rather than run away from the thing they fear in the dream. If we can be that conscious, as you were, the dream can hold profound lessons for us, as your dream had for you. Okay, I think that better wrap up the email for today. Hey, you can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. Alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And you know how much I love hearing from you. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Daniel Amen, for the interview. We close with a piece of PodSafe music, which seems particularly appropriate for our interview with Dr. Amen. It's called Teflon Brain by a husband and wife team out of South Carolina calling themselves 3 Feet Up. The song suggests we need a Teflon brain to let go of our negative attitudes and early programming. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Many people cling, they tenaciously adhere to outdated opinions and automatic fears. Ever since childhood, these captors have ruled, and maybe the time is now to get real and refuse. words that you hear influence you in many ways. You can't always detect where all the bias lays. And then before you know it, the trap has got you caught using other people's words. You could become their robot. Right now, take the bull by the horns and wash your programming down the drain. Right now, go and make your own way in life with a Teflon brain. A Teflon brain will set you free. What it should be. Nobody else can tell you your views. Who but you has a clue what you should do? Spring cleaning for the soul. Just throw that junk away. Down the